Welcome to Collective Choices. This is a podcast about where we choose to go from now on. Do we move towards a sustainable and peaceful future, or do we choose chaos? We have plenty to talk about in this podcast, and we need a lot of creativity to move forward. So today's guest is Tove Blomgren, Creative Director at Sally. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
What is Sally?
Sally is, in its current form, a future manifestation lab. So that means that we are, we made that up, by the way, so we're trying it out, which means that we are trying to find different ways of making people fall in love with a radically better future.
That means that, first of all, you need to convince them that it's something better than what they have.
Yeah, I think, see if I can remember the exact quote, but the best way to make someone... Oh, damn it. Can I look it up? I really should know this.
We're back and you found the quote. What's the quote?
Yeah. So you never change things by fighting the existing reality. To change something, build a new model that makes the existing model obsolete.
Right. Okay. I know that one. And it's true, but you have a couple of issues with that one as well. So first you need to communicate your new model and your newfound solution. So look, it's great. Try it, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And what's been remarkable to me over the past year, so we've been around in our current form for a year. Before that, we were more of an innovation hub working with clients. But our big realization with that was that the clients couldn't see what we could see. They wanted mostly incremental change. It was maybe a more sustainable packaging or, you know, an eco version of something. Whereas we see a completely different system. So we're like, how do we show them what this other world is? And that is so infinitely much better than the current system. So that's when we kind of changed our models. We're like, how can we visualize and manifest this radically better future in a way that makes people want to gravitate towards it? And in the past year, we've been looking at all the solutions that are already out there. And there are so many solutions. We know exactly what to do. We have everything that we need, but we're just not implementing it. So it's about finding those scalable solutions that are already out there, showing them in a way that is irresistible, and then spreading it to as many people as we can.
So you have something on your website where you describe that you are working with preferable futures.
Yes.
What is that?
So it's an old futurist method or speculative design method called the future cone, which is where you look into the future and it becomes more and more cone-shaped because it's more and more uncertain. But there is still a realm of possibility. And then you can look at what's possible, probable, plausible, and projected futures. And if we look at the projected future today, it's basically collapse. It's more than 3 degrees of warming by the end of the century. It's the death of the oceans. It's the end of biodiversity, etc. So that's not acceptable. So we need to find the preferable future that is still possible. It's not the projected one. It's quite far from it. But if we can start to visualize what that preferable future is, then we can backcast from that and see what did we do just before to make that future happen. And then we can backcast all the way to today. And that gives us the first step to course correct towards a different future.
Okay, so you are basically starting from the future.
Yes.
In a way.
Yeah.
So that's why on Sally's website, everything is written in past tense.
Yes.
Because it was funny, I was reading stuff like, back in 2020, people were doing this and it was not okay.
Yeah, we think that if we tell the story in present tense from a near future, so it's not science fiction, it's not some kind of abstract flying cars metaverse future, but it's a future that we could build today that is quite close, but it's just radically better. And if we can talk about the absurdities of this time that we're living in now, then we can create some kind of perspective shift in people's minds. And that's what we need now. We need these big mind shifts to see how insane this reality is that we're living right now, and it's not the best we can do.
So at Sally, you are basically a bunch of creative people that come up with different ideas that we, the other parts of society, should try. What did you think of until now?
So far, we've been looking at fashion, so preferable future of fashion, and seeing how that could work in a future where we produce a lot less clothes, like a lot less. The clothes that we do produce are made to last a lifetime. We share them in a way that is still fun and interesting and that we can express ourselves.
So it's not the future of Star Trek with the same uniform for everybody.
No, because we have to live within what people would accept. I mean, looking at possible futures, we also have to look at what's possible from everything we know about human behavior. So in the past, we've tried to create utopias a lot of times, and all of those were very value-driven, like this is how people should or supposed to be. And those ended with dictatorships and mass murder and imprisonment. So those kinds of utopias will never work. So we have to think about what is possible with everything we know about how people behave, what people think are fun and interesting and human connection. So we have to take all those things into. So it's not about us deciding what a good future is. It's creating the conditions for those futures.
I can see a struggle right here because many times people want different things that are not necessarily good for them long term. I mean, people will ask for parking spaces. They will ask for flying more and things like that because that's what they are used to and they want more of that lifestyle. Even though they are aware that it's not sustainable and we might hit a ceiling, they still ask for them. So why is that?
Yeah, so we're in this convenience mindset right now where for some decades now, we've been very focused on convenience.
So and comfort.
Convenience, comfort, yes. Abundance, choice, being able to get anything we want at any time. The thing is, that economy was built like a house of cards. We've built this whole economy on very expensive mortgages towards the future. And of course, the global south, who is not living this reality at all. So that it only works until it doesn't. I mean, unsustainable means just that it's not going to last anyway. So there's not going to be any frequent flyer miles in a 2-degree future. We know that that lifestyle is coming to an end, whether we like it or not. We have this huge change ahead. It's either going to be collapse or it's going to be us choosing a different way. This big regenerative rebuild, this huge project that humanity could engage in over the coming decades. But it's going to come to an end either way, and we're trying to make people understand that.
I feel that in recent years, this closing of the circle has become more visible because, okay, we have the climate manifestations that are more and more powerful, but also until now, we were producing, let's say, fashion items, mass producing them in the Western world. And when we wanted to get rid of them, they would magically disappear somewhere in Asia. Now that stops happening because more and more countries are rejecting that. So we are starting to see that the world is actually limited.
Yeah, there's this old report, was it from the 70s? There's limits to growth from
Stockholm, actually.
Yeah, that's so that, of course, nothing can grow forever. It's physically impossible. It's against the laws of nature. And our economy certainly cannot grow forever. I mean, it's like a child's fantasy. So we can only live like this degenerative economy that takes more than it gives back and wastes more, you know, than it creates value. It only works for so long. And we're seeing it come crashing down now. It's inflation, the energy prices, the wars, the conflicts. All of this is just going to get worse and worse. And yes, countries are going to stop saying or start saying no to things that they accepted before.
Basically, are we all rushing towards self-destruction to appease the shareholders?
I mean, we are very much hostages in this economic system, for sure. There's this really interesting concept, democratic concept, called citizens' assemblies. Do you know about them?
Yep.
Yeah.
Also from Stockholm recently.
Yeah, I think, I'm not sure, have we tried it here? But I know they have in Paris.
Some discussions were started here recently, or maybe it's something that I didn't know from Paris.
Yeah, because I know France has done it, Great Britain has done it. In Belgium, they're doing a permanent citizens' assembly. And it's basically jury duty, but for democracy. So instead of having these elections every 4 years, it's not working out so great.
No.
We're seeing the rise of fascism. I mean, we've seen it in, we're seeing it very presently in Sweden, of all countries. But citizens' assemblies, you're voting, you're picking randomly people to create a council that addresses hard questions. And the way it works is you have an expert and researchers who inform people, and then they deliberate, and then, yeah, there's a process to it. And what these councils agree on is degrowth, the end of airports, the end of over-consumerism, regreening, rewilding of cities, ending cars in cities. All of these proposals that in politics is super radical, but if you ask a sane person, these are just obvious choices that any rational person would make. So I think as long as we're jacked out of this system that we're trapped in of capitalism and eternal growth, most people understand that we're not satisfied by consumerism and fast fashion and eternal growth.
And I think most people are willing to try to go on that route if they wouldn't need to pay mortgages and, you know, make a living.
Yeah.
That's the main issue. That's how we are caught in the system. So, of course, you would like to save the jungle, but if you have a mortgage to pay, you're going to worry about that first.
Yeah, of course.
So it's really hard to get away from that.
Yeah, but it's also, I think you are so used to a certain lifestyle and you're told to desire all of these things that the economy wants you to desire. But as soon as you kind of pulled out of that, like me, for example, I used to love weekends in New York and shopping. And I thought of myself as a conscious person, but my lifestyle was insanely unsustainable. And then when I had this big crisis or awakening or whatever you want to say, I changed everything almost overnight because I was so terrified for my kids. And the thing is, I've never been happier than these past 4 or 5 years when I've given up flying. I've given up any kind of new consumption. Like I do buy secondhand sometimes, but it's much more mindful. And I don't miss anything about the old way.
But it was a decision that you made for yourself.
Yeah.
It wasn't anybody that told you, hey, you need to do this because otherwise it would be hard to swallow.
Yeah, it would have been very hard to swallow. So you have to, I think we have a huge job to do in educating people how dangerous this situation is, because most people still don't understand. They think that, of course, someone would do something if it really was that bad. That's what I thought.
So let's get back to the preferable futures that you are working with, because as we established so far, it's very important to have a vision, to have a model to show to people and convince them this is better for you, for everybody, and it's actually going to make you happier than you are now.
Yeah.
And I understand that you've been working with food and with fashion, trying to change these systems.
Yeah.
And also you are working with mobility in cities. Because it's a very hard topic as well. What are the solutions you are envisioning here?
So we're working with the preferable future of urban living. So it's a lot of different things. In this first phase, we've been just hanging out in this preferable future, trying to figure out what urban life could be, if it was the way it should be, within planetary boundaries and with for humans first, or for life first, rather. And Where do I start? You're into mobility. So yeah, the cars. Let's start with the cars. Yeah, that's the big thing, which I think is, again, such a big mind shift, because a few years ago, I didn't even question cars in cities. Like, of course, you have cars and streets everywhere, and then you have crossing places, and then you have to ask your kids to be careful and look everywhere. But once you start to see how bizarre it is that people get to drive around in these 2-ton steel boxes, polluting the air, taking up the space, putting that 2-ton steel thing almost wherever next to the street and take up that space, then you start to go out into the city and see it differently. It's like, why is the car the dominant force in cities?
And not us, the people.
Yeah. And once you start to understand how, you know, we have more parking space than living space, for example, in Stockholm. How bizarre is that? For to move a car, you spend 95% of that energy to move the actual car, not the passenger.
Yes.
So it's extremely wasteful. I think in Europe, most cars are parked 93% of the time. The time you're actually driving, a fifth of that is just looking for parking. So
It's a crazy inefficient system. And somehow, I mean, we as a society, a technologically advanced society, we've been great at doing things more efficient. Like take computers. They were like the size of the room some decades ago, and now they're the size of a smartphone. And somehow for cars, we've been doing it the other way around. We've been making cars bigger and heavier, and it's a bit crazy.
And everything that comes with that is that we need paving everywhere, because we have such heavy cars that they need like this really heavy paving, and that kills everything underneath it. So there are no microbes, there is no life in the soil underneath, or you actually remove the topsoil when you put down asphalt or you pave something. So our whole cities is just full of dead soil, polluted air, all this space taken up by cars.
But I understand your preferable future looks better.
How, yes.
Tell us about it.
So we are in research mode. So I'm sure I would love to hear from you as well, because you know even more about this than me. But micromobility hubs placed out very accessible in the cities, where you have free bikes, you have electric bikes, you have cargo bikes, small vehicles to get around. Do you know in Ljubljana?
Yes.
Yeah, it's like this car-free city. They have small electric buses that just stop when you wave them down like a cab.
Oh, wow.
But they're free, so you jump on them and you go around that way.
Stockholm has a free boat that's like that.
Do we?
Yes, in Hammarby.
Okay, yeah, I know which one you
mean. So it's basically a small lake, and there's a boat that takes people across that lake all the time, every day, from like 6 in the morning till midnight, completely free, and it's absolutely great. And this as a concept works very well, I imagine, if more cities try to implement it, like in Ljubljana, you were saying. Coupled with bike sharing schemes, it can be a very powerful system to get around the city. I mean, you don't need to go great distances to get around the city. You just need like 10 kilometers, 20 kilometers, something like that. And you can easily cover that with some buses and the bike and the trains and trams.
Yeah. And the other thing is, of course, make it walkable and bikeable. And that is not just about having roads to connect different places, but it's about making those places interesting and beautiful and pleasurable.
I think that's the next level. I mean, some cities are just trying to figure out if they need to build bike lanes. They don't have them, you know. But surely in a preferable future, it would be nice to have the bike lanes placed, you know, I don't know, by the water, under some trees, to have shade and to enjoy that experience as well.
Yeah, I think it's so inspiring to see what they're doing in Paris now. There used to be this very heavy traffic, or still is, but it's now kind of pioneering this 15-minute city and doing it by the Seine, turning that into bike lanes.
So Paris was one of those cities that they would tell you, oh, we're not Amsterdam, we cannot do that cycling thing, you know, but now they can.
And in London as well, they just passed, bikes just became the biggest mode of transportation in London.
Oh, wow, didn't know that.
So things are moving, and there is this article from Wired, I think had a great title, is Everyone Hates a Car-Free City Until They Live in One. So it's like once you've experienced a car-free city, then you don't want to go back to the way it was. And that's true for so many of these sustainable solutions and preferable futures. Like once you experience that world, you're never going to want to go back.
I think the pandemic helped us in that way because many cities tried a few things in terms of mobility during COVID, and we got to see how it could be different. And in some places it worked, and those solutions are being implemented as permanent. So it's kind of the mechanism you are trying, you know, to put up a vision and show it and let people experience it, and maybe they will adopt it. So the preferable future of mobility, how does it work exactly in the cities of the future? Let's say big metropolis, like 20 million people.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is that it's not about mobility per se, it's about accessibility. People don't want to move just for the sake of moving. Exactly. They want to move to get to somewhere. So I think the worst examples you have is like American cities with this suburban sprawls, with big suburbia that has nothing. Doesn't even have maybe a grocery store. It doesn't have schools or preschool. Of course, you have to take your car to go into the city where those services are. So the first thing is to do mixed neighborhoods where you have access to all of those services that you need as a citizen. And I'm super privileged. I live at Södermalm. I have my preschool at Södermalm. I work at Södermalm. I have everything I need within 15 minutes or so.
But
so.
Then again, Americans will tell you that, hey, but that's Europe because it's densely populated. But any city can be densely populated if you don't put parking lots in the center of it, you know?
Yeah, it's a problem. Once you've established the city structure, it's really hard to break it up. But it is possible.
It is possible.
Yeah, and a lot of progressive cities are working on that. Even Detroit, you know, that you might not see as this progressive.
A car city, yeah.
Yeah, they are working with that, and they're working with urban farming, bringing communities together through farming and converting parking space into farms. There is a way to do things, but we have to be brave enough to go against this small group of protesters who are going to be there always. And even now, they're doing one street in Stockholm that's going to be bikes first and cars second. And immediately, this small, I'm going to say, often men, very attached to their cars for some reason, they're going to start protesting. And as a leader, you're going to have to weather that storm. I mean, Anne Hidalgo in Paris, she's been through the ringer, so many protests and demonstrations. But if you stand, you have to stand firm and still carry through. And then people are never going to miss it.
But what do you tell those people who are protesting at the start? How can you tell them, hey, there is a better future waiting even for you as a driver?
Yeah, it's super hard. I think there's a small minority that you're never going to convince. It's like the climate deniers or...
Right.
And if you try to go into discussions with them, it's useless. We don't have time for that. So I think what you need is to bring on the majority of people who actually do want a better future and who is willing to do small sacrifices of convenience to build something better. And once you get those on board, then the others will follow. So, I mean, it's like gay marriage, for example. That was like a really strong protest just a few years ago. That was almost unthinkable in the US, for example. And if you would have argued with those people that the loud minority was against it, you would never have gotten anywhere. Instead, you kind of...
Try it out and...
Yeah, you partnered with the ones that were for it, and then they got the legislation passed. You partnered with young people. And then the small minority is now like, yeah, I was always kind of for that. You cannot start with the small reactionary people who hate change because you're never going to get them on board. So start with the ones who actually are willing to move. It's like when we banned smoking in bars in Stockholm. There was a really loud minority who were so upset. And once you do it, then everyone's like, how on earth could we smoke inside? That was insane.
While eating, yes.
Yeah. But I think what's interesting with the smoking ban was that was actually the unions that organized that for the staff that was working in the bars because they had really bad environment, obviously, because they were in the smoky environment all the time.
Exactly.
So they made it into a workers' health issue, and that's how they got it passed.
You mentioned urban farming a bit earlier, and that's one of the key points in your preferable future for the food system, because it's one of the key solutions going forward. More and more people are living in urban areas, and in order to cut on the emissions and the logistical problems from global transportation chains for food, we need to grow our food closer to home. So that would mean in the cities or near the cities. And that has an effect on transport as well. So I imagine it's part of your vision for mobility and transport.
Yeah. And the urban farming is one of those solutions that isn't necessarily about volume. So we don't think or we're under no impressions that you will be able to get a majority of food from urban farming. But it's about the closeness to food. Because we lost connection to how food is grown when it just appears in our shelves in plastic.
And also a bit of control, I would say. You are at the mercy of global supply chains.
And... Yeah. Yeah, and there's something, there's like statistics about how people who farm are happier. Because it's like the act of farming is bringing life into the world. And it's very therapeutic. And there's like microbes in the soil that is good for you. So it's such a win-win. I'm a newbie. I started last summer. It's kind of hard, but the satisfaction of eating my own Brussels sprouts that I grew on my balcony, it's a part to none.
It's even, as you said, therapeutic, because lots of people are super stressed in the city and they need different activities that connect them to nature, and this would help them in more ways than one.
Yeah.
So tell me if in these preferable futures of yours, you see more hope than, you know, the other darker part.
Oh, that's the hard question. There's a lot of people who are now reaching the point of it's too late. It's no use. It's too hard. And I understand that. If you look at the situation we're in right now, it's really difficult to remain optimistic. But what my approach to that is, first of all, I mean, you cannot say it's too late or I give up when it comes to all life on Earth. There's just no way you can just say, well, it's too hard. We haven't even tried.
Exactly.
So what I've decided is that until the last tree is burning around me, I'm going to say that it's not too late, because that's the only option. There is no giving up on life on Earth. And the other one is this very selfish or self-serving thing, but it's being able to look my kids in the eye and said, you know, I did what I could when I understood how bad it was. And that's a motivation that is almost beyond if there is hope or not. And again, it may be selfish, but for me, it works as this way of just...
And also there's another pragmatic opinion, because it can get a lot worse. So maybe we want to avoid that for our own comfort.
Yeah, and this is not binary. I mean, there are really dangerous tipping points, but yes, there is always going to be a place that is worse. So every fraction of a degree, or every species that we can save, or every hectare of wild nature that we can save matters. I know that for sure. So whatever I can do, I'm going to do it. But it's very easy to feel hopeless when you see where the world is headed. But the thing that gives me the most hope is that these tipping points that are so dangerous in nature, there are social tipping points that can happen as quick. And you might have heard this, that you need 20% of a population to bring about this big societal
change. Yeah.
And we did approach those tipping points before the pandemic with the Fridays for Future. There's a lot of research saying that we were about to approach one of those. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we can get there again.
That raises an interesting question. If somebody saw that society is changing globally, maybe they said, I cannot have that. Let's put some pressure on society and let's do some bad stuff to, you know, take people's mind off of this change.
Yeah,
I don't know, I'm just saying.
Yeah. We want to go into conspiracy theory. I think that was just really bad timing. And I think a lot of people hoped that the COVID was going to be this restart of this Green New Deal, this new way of living. And I honestly think that the reason that it wasn't, I mean, apart from being trapped in this economic system, it was also that we lacked this vision of what comes next. So until we have a common project or a common idea of what's on the other side, it's going to be impossible to build it. We cannot build what we cannot imagine. So that's why I think we need these new stories so badly. So if we can start to see something else, that's when we can start to create it together.
I think humans are, in a way, cursed, let's say, because they are capable of great change, but only when they hit the wall and when, you know, after some great deal of suffering, they will rise from the ashes and they will understand, okay, so peace is nice to have. Let's have peace and cooperation. And then they forget it and they go back in circles. So, but I'm hopeful that once we are hitting this ceiling, and we are going to hit it, people are going to get really creative and maybe try to finally work together somehow.
Yeah, and we can do amazing things when we try. And I think the COVID pandemic showed us that once we put our minds to a common problem or project, as the vaccine, for example, that happened in record time. No one thought that was possible.
I think the key word here is cooperation instead of competition.
Yes.
Somehow this economic system taught us and brainwashed us that competition is a must, and that's how the world works, but it doesn't. That's how you destroy the world. So only cooperation, I think, can move us forward, but we need to somehow become convinced of that ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah, we talk a lot about being in a post-competition mindset. So we don't have any competitors. There are no other agencies or labs or anything. So we're super transparent. We share everything. We share all of our learnings. We meet everyone who wants to meet us. But in this question, there are only winners. You know, if one win, we all win when it comes to the transition.
Okay. So we are still optimistic about the future. Thank you for this interview. So join me next time on Collective Choices. Thank you.